Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
There is a sense that this city has been a sort of sleeping beauty for many years and it needs to grasp that sense of modernity.
After 46 years, Paris is set to welcome a brand new skyscraper. But how will it change the city? And more importantly, how do Parisians feel about it? This week, we take a look at this and other stories that have caught our attention recently, including a brand new photography book showcasing Atlantic City today, and how much of its demise can be blamed on the current US president. Plus, what is the sick building syndrome? Don't worry, it's not contagious. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's programme. We start today in the United States with a look at Atlantic City. Created in the mid-19th century, this was once the resort town of excellence on the East Coast, with casinos, hotels, and plenty of entertainment all round. Today, the picture is quite different. The boom is no more, and one person's failed investment is at the centre of the city's demise, Donald J. Trump. Brian Rose is a photographer and an artist, and in the aftermath of the presidential election, he decided to head over to Atlantic City and to use it as an example of the dangers of the man who had just become president. Well, according to him. He told Monocle's Carlotta Rebello all about his work and where he thinks the city is today.
When Donald Trump was elected, I was quite shocked, like a lot of people. I expected Hillary Clinton to win. And having been a New Yorker for a long time, I was well aware of Trump's history and generally the fact that he was considered a fraud here in the city for a long, long time. And so the fact that he could get elected and become president of the United States, I saw it as a potentially worldwide calamity. This was somebody who should never come anywhere close to the levers of power. So I decided that I, as a photographer and as an artist, I needed to do something. So I felt compelled to do something directly political, which I've not generally done in the past. So I rented a car and I drove down to Atlantic City, knowing something about how Atlantic City had been a sort of scene of Donald Trump's bankruptcies and his casino businesses and all of that. And so that's basically how it happened. It was a direct response to the election.
Now, just to paint a picture for our listeners that might have never been to Atlantic City or are not familiar with it, we're speaking here about a place that really illustrates that fraud aspect of Donald Trump that you were mentioning before, all, you know, the failed casino projects. Can you just kind of describe what you encountered when you arrived there?
Well, Atlantic City, you know, it's actually quite an old city in the United States. It goes back to the mid-19th century. And it was always a resort community with hotels and entertainments of all kinds. And there's a history there of the kind of thing that went on in the 1920s, in the Prohibition era. It's always had a sort of sheen of family friendliness, but at the same time always had a kind of underside to it as well. And it went into great decline in the 50s and 60s. When America became more mobile and people could go other places for vacation. So as a way of trying to rescue the city, New Jersey decided to allow casino gambling. So these huge casinos were built along the boardwalk, and Donald Trump saw that as an opportunity, and he got into the casino business, and he was really the most important figure there for a couple of decades.
Now, you were saying that you went there prompted by the result of the election. Upon arrival, would you see people supportive of Trump, who would make America great again signs and still championing his message? Or was the city kind of feeling the same disarray as the buildings you've described?
It was kind of a mixed bag. I talked to a number of people. Physically, the place is very depressed looking, aside from the casinos, which are kind of these islands of glitz and ostentatiousness. But the rest of the city is very much, it's a pretty poor place, and it has all of the urban problems of bigger cities, drugs and homelessness and things like that. So you talk to people, and it kind of depends on who you talk to. Most people see Trump's legacy pretty negatively there. But there are people who think, well, you know, it was great in the 80s and 90s. Things were going better here. We had more jobs, more money. And now there's a sense that they were ripped off and Donald Trump walked away at a moment when things started to go the wrong way. I actually saw a group of women at one point when I was taking my pictures carrying Make America Great Again signs. I have no idea why they were there or where they were coming from, but it just struck me that this was incredibly ironic that here in the, you know, in the center of Trump's failure, his business failures, they were carrying these signs.
Now, it's interesting as well, I assume, as a photographer, trying to illustrate all of that, and as an artist as well, because looking at some of the images, it really resembles a ghost town. You kind of can almost imagine in your head what sort of life would have unfolded in the streets or in the buildings. Was that striking to you as well, to kind of be face-to-face with a demise of what had been a place always packed with people in the resorts, the casinos, etc.?
Well, what happens with the casinos is that everything is internal. So you can walk around Atlantic City and get the sense that there aren't that many people there, when actually there may be thousands of people inside the casinos. The way these places are designed, you don't really need to come out, or you're discouraged from coming out, actually. You don't really know whether it's daytime or nighttime when you're inside one of these casinos. And the other thing to remember is that New Jersey, it's here in the Northeast. So the climate is cold for much of the year. As a beach town, it's really only in 3-4 months of the year that you have the kind of outdoor activity on the beach and the boardwalk. The rest of the year, it's quite desolate there. So when you're seeing a lot of emptiness, I mean, that is the way it looks much of the time. It's not a huge city. It has about 38,000 people. The boardwalk can get quite crowded in the summer. But aside from that, I found it to be very spooky how few people there were in most of the city.
Now, this is, of course, a place that, as you described earlier, had gone into demise, had, was poor before Donald Trump, after his investment in the city, still now that he's president, still remains a poor place. Do you feel like through your work you're able to capture that essence of it? Or is it quite tricky considering that, you know, he is now the president of the United States?
I felt from the very beginning that there was something here I could really work with. Photography can only do so much in a direct way. But what you want to do is to have people pay attention to things. So that's much of what I do, is I'm just showing people the things that I see. And I knew that Atlantic City would be a kind of expression for a lot of what was going on in the United States. You know, way back in the 80s, when Louis Malle made a film about Atlantic City, he said something about it being a metaphor for things gone wrong in America. And I think now, in particular, with the legacy of Donald Trump there and his election as president, Atlantic City, more than ever, is a kind of metaphor for a lot of things that have gone wrong in the United States. And I think you can see it there. The discrepancy between the huge casinos and the older city, where you have wealth here and poverty right next door, that kind of thing is, I think, becoming more and more the case in the U.S., and I think Atlantic City shows that.
Now, you've been back to Atlantic City a couple of times since you started a project. Were you able to tell the difference in the city, or does it still resemble the same way as when you first photographed it?
It's basically the same. There were 4 abandoned casinos when I was doing my pictures. I finished just last year in 2018, so a lot of the pictures are quite recent. The book just came out this year. So two of the casinos have reopened with different owners, and people are saying, oh, Atlantic City is making a comeback. And in the sense that those two casinos have opened, yes, that's true. But what has not changed is the one-dimensionality of the economy of the city. That hasn't changed at all. So the physical appearance of the city has not changed. You know, the fortunes of the people living in the city have not significantly changed. Many of the employees at these casino hotels don't even live in Atlantic City. They live 30 minutes away and drive in.
That was the photographer Brian Rose speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Rabello. And his book, Atlantic City, is published by Circa and is out right now. Paris's urban silhouette has stayed pretty much unchanged since 1973, but that's about to change as the city has approved the construction of a brand new skyscraper, the first in 46 years. The triangle-shaped tower will be ready in time for the 2024 Olympics, but what sort of legacy will it leave afterwards? And will it be embraced by the locals? Well, Monocle's senior correspondent in the city, Sophie Grove, told David Stevens all about it.
It's a saga. It really was approved back in 2008 when it was first mooted, this enormous triangular tower by Herzog de Meuron, which is controversially within the city centre of Paris, near the Porte de Versailles. So it's the first really tall structure that's been proposed in Paris since the Tour de Montparnasse, which was constructed in the late 70s, and just was so badly received by Parisians that it was really sort of decided never again. It was not just the tower, but the whole kind of demolition of some of the kind of beautiful areas of Montparnasse, where it was this artistic, bohemian, partially derelict area of Paris. And people were so dismayed that really the consensus became no more towers in Paris.
Obviously, never again only lasted about 45 years, and we're facing another big tower in Paris. Why has this come up now? Why has this been allowed to happen now?
Well, I think it was really the mayor's office. Mayor Hidalgo is a socialist. She's quite unsentimental in many ways. She's really a modernist, and Paris is facing some of the big problems that London and other cities have: expensive housing, really overcrowding. There's a housing crisis here, and there is a need to densify and build. So she's launched a project to kind of really fill in some of the brownfield sites that have been in Paris that have just been sort of unloved, unused. And that's been very well received most of the time. A few controversies around the place and lots of green architecture, wooden skyscrapers are going up. But this one is very totemic. This is an extremely tall structure, 42 stories, because it's in quite a sort of, I don't know, an iconic spot, really. And it's surrounded by a community that seems very resistant to it and very vocally resistant to it. So then we've seen it bouncing in and out of the courts, municipal discussions for the best part of a decade. So it's really become this sort of extremely iconic sort of battle for Hidalgo, whether she's going to get her way with this and sort of break this watershed moment for Paris.
And you mentioned the size of the building. It's also a pyramid shape, so it actually takes up a lot of ground space as well. Can you explain what the site is like at the moment? Is it empty space? Are they going to have to demolish things to make this happen?
Well, it's at a crossroads. I mean, when you go down to the ports of Paris, they are very desolate in some ways. These are the places that they're almost like giant bus station areas. They're not absolutely beautiful, but there are some quite lovely buildings in the area. And the residents, groups calling themselves things like SOS Paris and France Nature. There's another one called the Association for Harmonious Development of the Porte de Versailles. They're the ones that are behind the court action to restrict the permit. So they're saying, you know, this is not harmonious with the area. It's not Parisian. I think part of the feeling is Paris has this equilibrium. It's a very dense city. It's one of the densest, in fact, it is the most densely populated city in Europe, but you can't feel it. And that's quite the charm of it, really. These Haussmannian buildings, they're quite tall, deceptively tall, and very packed with people, but you don't have that sense of, you know, Hong Kong. You know, you look up, you see the sky in most streets in Paris. And I think people are very attached to that feeling and that aesthetic. And this feels like a departure. It feels like this is the thin end of the wedge. We start with maybe a quite interesting building in the form of this award-winning architectural practice and a triangle, but what next? And up until now, all the towers have been clustered down in La Défense, which is the area of commerce. And, you know, it's really siphoned off. You go down there and you have this kind of Blade Runner moment where you think, my gosh, this is where it's the modernism is. And Macron and the sort of city is really pushing a sort of rebuilding effort there. 7 new towers are planned to open in La Défense. And nobody had any problems with that. So the controversy really lies in the kind of historic Paris and the kind of ideal of Paris, which has been protected for so many years. And suddenly we're finding this mayor who's not as sentimental as some of the Parisians, you know, who really, I don't know, they really bask in the sort of preserved charm of Paris.
Politically, this seems like quite bad timing as well, obviously with the Yellow Vest movement still rolling on, and you mentioned history there, the fire at Notre Dame still fresh in people's mind. How do you think citizens will view this kind of juxtaposition of events?
It feels like Paris really is at a crossroads. I mean, the sense that it needs to move forward and there's a lot of urgent updating that needs to be done to the transport network. The Olympics are coming in 2024. There is a sense that this city has been a sort of sleeping beauty for many years and it needs to grasp that sense of modernity and become more sustainable and become bigger as well. The expansion of Paris and this Grand Paris project is redeveloping the suburbs and trying to get a sense that it's great, you know, to bring the suburbs into the concept of Paris, because so many people are very attached to central Paris within the periphery. And in a way, Notre Dame is the heart of all of that. It's the ground zero of the Parisian identity. And it was a harrowing experience for all Parisians, really. I mean, certainly for people who lived in town, it felt, even to me, like an assault on the city and its identity, and a huge setback. I mean, when you're looking at all these challenges that the city has, to then see something burn like that completely uncontrollably and this sense of devastation, it felt hopeless. I think the funny thing about the Notre Dame catastrophe is that the sense of determination that Parisians have grabbed afterwards, I mean, there's a real sense of the effort to rebuild, turning over the page, and even some of the suggestions for the kind of reconstruction of the roof of Notre Dame have been incredibly modern. And in fact, people are talking about that very open-mindedly. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I think it would probably be something quite classic involving wood in the end. But I think Parisians are really open to new ideas. But it does seem that towers, really tall towers, just really seem to to rile debate and divide opinion in a way that just you wouldn't really find in any other city.
That was Monocle's senior correspondent, Sophie Grove, speaking to David Stevens. The modernist architect Erno Goldfinger believed that within the same building, space and form should be mutable to best follow function. But applying his principles today is not so straightforward, especially as more and more office spaces are converted into residential ones. Monocle's Augustin Macellari caught up with the architect Jack Self, who's also the director of the Real Foundation, to discuss how these conversions are changing our cities and the people who live in them.
Goldfinger, the definition that you gave sounded very kind of complex, but in a way it's very simple, which is you should in principle design good, useful spaces with good proportions, ideally based on environmental conditions. I mean, of course, the sort of bread and butter of British building, and especially in London, is the terrace house. The terrace house is a kind of perfect combination of structural and material possibilities. So the width of the frontages is based on the longest piece of wood that they could get from the shipyards at the time. And then you've got these party walls which hold up everything in between. But the depth of the rooms and the heights of the ceilings are always determined by being able to get enough light at the back of the room to read a book during the day. So there was a kind of environmental sensibility right from the beginning. Of course, they always have two rooms adjoining so that you can get cross ventilation. And these tend to create exactly what Goldfinger was talking about, which is general spaces which have a kind of nice proportion and very limited deterministic qualities that lead to a kind of positive psychological health and environmental comfort, as well as using very simple materials that tend not to have the synthetic properties which Goldfinger used in that particular building. I mean, these particulates, whether that's asbestos, whether that's fiberglass, which is used in the various ducts, I mean, the second part of what Goldfinger's talking about is in a way far more consequential for sick building syndrome, which is we're talking about services and we're talking about the way in which utilities, ducts, all of the machinery, what we call HVAC in architecture, the heating, the ventilation, the air conditioning, all of these things come together in order, and they're made up of such complex systems that it's often very difficult to anticipate how different materials are going to interact with each other. And as a result, it's very difficult when you see the symptoms to work out what might be causing such a thing. I mean, it could come from many different causes.
One of the things that we were discussing just before we came on air was this idea of functional and non-functional space. And I'm kind of interested to hear you expand on how a domestic property can maintain this degree of mutability. You could put a bedroom upstairs or downstairs. You could install a bathroom in whichever room you care to. But how that kind of blends into commercial space, which, as we see now in London, is increasingly being converted for domestic use.
I think we have to be really careful in the way in which commercial space is being converted into domestic spaces, because the underlying standards and proportions used for them are very, very different. I mean, most construction systems for offices don't have considerations for things like sonic and thermal insulation. You know, offices are not used generally during the night, which means that you don't have to worry if the temperature of the building drops during that period. You don't have to really worry if noise carries between one floor and another, because office life is in its nature kind of often involves a lot of sound, whereas the standards for domestic life are much higher. So I'm not surprised that in the process of converting that, you know, there would have been all sorts of insulation and other types of materials that go in almost like a house inside a house in order to create this sort of bubble interior. And so we can probably assume that there was some sort of material being used in that building that was irritating people. And it was probably compounded by the design of the space and its poor ventilation and poor ability to be used. Today's push towards minimum standards around space planning and other types of conditions mean that we have the lowest possible ceilings that we can. So we need a lot of electric spotlights in order to light the dark interiors. We often have rooms which are the minimum size, so you can only arrange a bed in one way. You can only put a sofa of a particular length. And this kind of lack of, on the one hand, it's a lack of generosity, but it's also a lack of kind of future-proofing, because buildings have long lifespans. And if you think about building, say, a home that was designed in the 1950s, its arrangement of rooms, as well as its ability to incorporate things like air conditioning or the invention of the internet, the ability to add more things in terms of the services that Goldfinger was talking about, but also the ability to adapt to changing forms of life, becomes very, very difficult.
The reason that sick building syndrome leapt out at me is because I think there is something quite poetic about it as a concept. Goldfinger was, of course, famous for high-rise buildings. I mentioned the Trellick Tower, which is iconic. And this way of living is a way that J.G. Ballard explored, that various writers kind of engage with, because it was new in the mid-20th century, or it was emerging as a model for how people would go on to live. I wondered how sick building syndrome stands relative to that, whether there's something about this kind of way of living that is so against people's more atavistic needs, their kind of deep natures, that this response is triggered, or if this, if you kind of think this is just a bit of an anachronistic, slightly wishy-washy kind of idea.
No, not at all. I mean, to put it in a little bit of context, we should kind of understand where these types of visions of one building, almost like the building as a city. I mean, in High Rise by Ballard, we see him basically take a building by Le Corbusier called Unité d'Habitation in Marseille, which was a kind of concept that you would have swimming pools and creches and gyms and shops and all of these functions that were inside the building along with your housing that in a way you never needed to leave. And the origin of that dates back also to the early 20th century. A Russian architect was very influential in this, Ginzburg, who designed the Ministry for Finance in Moscow. And this basically set the beginning of this as a logic of putting everything in one building. And of course, what the Soviets were trying to do at that time in the beginning of the USSR and this kind of communist idea was they knew that every single capitalist crash, every market crash had been triggered by a housing bubble. I mean, it's still the case, you know, even as recently as 2008, every market crash begins with a housing crash. And so they wanted to eliminate this problem by building as much housing as they could. And this leads eventually to kind of concrete panel housing and an idea that you just build as much as you can, as quickly as you can, with a view to avoiding possibility of shortfall or shortage in the housing market. This was then imported as a way of building into East Germany, and then the East Germans sold it to the French and the British, which is how you end up by the 1960s. With the legacy of both this kind of modernism and also concrete panel construction, which became very kind of influential. But of course, you know, their ambition and their intention, I think, was a good one, which was, it's sometimes easy to forget that after World War II, you know, more than half the country didn't have indoor toilets. People were living in bombed out houses, and the quality of the built environment was very poor. And the ambition of groups like the London County Council, which at that time was the largest architectural firm in the world, all of these architects working anonymously, I mean, Goldfinger is a kind of aberration in this, but most never really had their names attached. People like Neave Brown, who built amazing social housing around London, their ambition was to modernize society and to provide for people, to give them air conditioning, to give them hot and cold running water, a garbage chute so that they could easily dispose of their waste. So as long as you have a society where there's a strong sense of social solidarity and commitment to working with your neighbors, then these types of buildings can work. We still see them working exceptionally well in very kind of culturally homogenous societies like the Nordic countries and Japan. But in societies which are more heterogeneous, not just culturally, but socially and socioeconomically, when you get mixed models of tenure and mixed classes all living in the same building, there tends to be a disincentive for people to work together. And this kind of leads to buildings not being maintained properly. You start to get things like legionnaires in the air conditioning vents. You start to get poor maintenance of common water or other utilities. And that leads to the types of conditions that you're talking about.
That was the architect Jack Self speaking to Augustin Macellari. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Context with City Samba. Thank you for listening, city lovers.